New York. This is Democracy Now!
We had a fireplace and I burnt up all the wood we had. This is sad. This is a sad state of affairs. I wish it were better, but, you know, somebody's got to do some planning after all this is over and make sure there's an alternative source of energy.
Millions of Texans were plunged into freezing cold and darkness after a major winter storm overwhelmed the state's power grid, which is independent from the rest of the country, to avoid federal regulation. Republican Governor Greg Abbott's trying to blame renewable energy. Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal, which isn't even in place yet, for the state's blackouts. We'll go to Houston to speak with Professor Robert Bullard, known as the father of environmental justice, about the disproportionate effect on low-income communities and communities of color, which have also been hit harder by the pandemic. Then, as COVID-19 infection rates go down, the CDC says it's too soon to lift mask mandates.
The bottom line is this. Masks work, and they work best when they have a good fit and are worn correctly.
We'll speak with infectious disease Dr. Monica Gandhi about which masks to wear, how to wear them, and how many. Then we look at mounting pressure for President Biden to cancel student debt.
President Joe Biden has a remarkable opportunity to unite a broad coalition of individuals together behind full student loan debt cancellation. So if Joe Biden were to not cancel student loan debt, frankly, it would be not only politically incomprehensible, but it would possibly set up the conditions that got us President Trump in the first place.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Millions of people in Texas are suffering as a new winter storm hits the state amidst a deadly power and water crisis. As Texas experiences record low temperatures, more than 600,000 homes remain without power after the collapse of Texas' own underregulated electrical grid. Some Texans are sleeping in their cars for heat. More than 12 million Texans face water disruptions. Residents in Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and other areas have been ordered to boil tap water to ensure its safety, but many don't have electricity to do it. Some parts of the state have no running water at all. Texas is also running out of food as the storms have disrupted key supply chains. The powerful winter storms have left at least 38 people dead across Texas and other states. We'll go to Houston, Texas, after headlines. Life expectancy in the United States fell by a full year during the first 6 months of 2020, largely due to the coronavirus pandemic. It's the largest drop since World War II. Life expectancy for Black Americans dropped 2.7 years and 1.9 years for Latinx people. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the overall death rate from COVID-19 for Black Americans is three times higher than for white Americans. Meanwhile, in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is defending his decision to prioritize giving vaccines to wealthy Floridians living in two mostly white planned communities with ties to the billionaire Uline family, one of the biggest donors to the Republican Party. On Wednesday, Governor DeSantis threatened to block vaccines from going to communities that criticize his actions.
But look, I mean, if Manatee County doesn't like us doing this, then we are totally fine with putting this in counties that want it. And we're totally happy to do that.
At the United Nations, Mexico has denounced wealthy nations for hoarding COVID vaccines, saying the unequal distribution system will harm the globe. This is Mexican Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard speaking earlier this week.
We are going to present Mexico and Latin America's position in regards to what is happening in the world. The inequality, the lack of fairness when it comes to vaccine access. The countries that produce vaccines have very high vaccination rates, and Latin America and the Caribbean, much less.
In Mexico, less than 1% of the population has received at least one vaccine shot, compared to over 12% in the United States. Over 177,000 people have died from COVID in Mexico, the world's third highest total after the U.S. and Brazil. According to the World Health Organization, there were nearly 130 countries as of last week with no vaccines. On Wednesday, Gaza received 2,000 doses of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine after the shipment was initially blocked by Israel. Gaza health authorities say the first vaccines will go to at-risk residents, but not medical personnel, since there are not enough doses. Meanwhile, El Salvador and South Africa have also begun vaccination programs. New research shows top executives at Pfizer, Moderna, Merck, and other vaccine manufacturers sold nearly $500 million of stock last year as the value in the company soared due to the pandemic. The FBI and the U.S. attorney in Brooklyn have opened a probe into New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo for covering up thousands of deaths in nursing homes during the pandemic. More than 15,000 nursing home residents died in New York, nearly double what Cuomo had initially disclosed. Meanwhile, Democratic New York Assemblyman Ron Kim has revealed Cuomo called him at home last week to threaten him for speaking out about the issue. Kim said Cuomo threatened to, quote, destroy me, unquote. This comes as New York lawmakers prepare to vote next week on stripping Governor Cuomo of emergency executive powers during the pandemic. Democratic lawmakers are introducing President Biden's immigration plan to Congress today. The legislation includes an 8-year path to citizenship for the nation's 11 million undocumented immigrants. Some immigrants could face a shorter process, including farm workers and recipients of DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and immigrants who have temporary protected status, or TPS. In other news from Washington, D.C., Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Elizabeth Warren have criticized Biden for refusing to back a plan to cancel $50,000 in student debt. We'll have more on the debate over student debt later in the broadcast. In Burma, protesters have taken to the streets for a 13th straight day to oppose the February 1st military coup. On Wednesday, hundreds of thousands of people marched in Rangoon in the largest anti-coup rally to date. Some protesters rallied outside the Chinese embassy to criticize Beijing's support for the military junta. Nearly 500 people have been charged and detained in Burma over the past 2 weeks. Bolivia's central bank has returned a nearly $350 million loan from the International Monetary Fund, which had been given to Bolivia after the 2019 coup. The head of Bolivia's central bank said the move was needed to defend the economic sovereignty of Bolivia. President Biden spoke to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Wednesday for the first time since taking office 4 weeks ago. According to the White House, the leaders discussed Iran military cooperation, as well as Biden's support for Israel's recent normalization of ties with several countries in the Arab and Muslim world. Meanwhile, the White House has announced it'll, quote, recalibrate its relationship with Saudi Arabia by holding talks with Saudi King Salman instead of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. In other news from the Gulf, the BBC's aired video of a princess in Dubai who says she's being held hostage by her father, the Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates, a close ally of the United States. Princess Sheikha Latifa has not been seen in public since she tried to escape the UAE in 2018.
I'm a hostage, and this villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. I've been by myself, solitary confinement, no access to medical help, no trial, no charge, nothing.
Again, that was Princess Sheikha Latifa speaking in a newly aired video. Her older sister Shamsa hasn't been seen in over 20 years since being seized on the streets of Cambridge, England, after she tried to flee her family's estate. The U.S. has approved nearly $200 million in arms sales to Egypt, despite ongoing human rights abuses. This comes as Egyptian-American activist Mohammed Sultan said Tuesday Egyptian authorities raided the homes of his family members, taking some into detention. In northern Nigeria, unidentified gunmen have kidnapped as many as 42 students and teachers at a boarding school. At least one student was killed. Amnesty International described the attack as a possible war crime and called on the Nigerian government to do more to protect students. The South Carolina House has passed a sweeping anti-choice bill to ban nearly all abortions in Alabama. Democrats criticize Republicans for prioritizing the bill over all other legislation at a time when the state is facing a health and economic crisis. The White House has announced President Biden supports studying whether reparations for slavery should be given to Black Americans. On Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the issue. Speakers included UCLA law professor Tendi Achume.
Reparations is about undoing structures of racial injustice that are a result of legacy and legacies of enslavement, such that pointing to individuals who are Black, who have succeeded, who are people of African descent and who are descendants even of slaves, and pointing to their successes can't negate the fact that we have persisting structures of injustice that have to be addressed, including through a reparations frame.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development is facing criticism for failing to protect residents in federally subsidized housing from lead poisoning and contamination. An internal watchdog report obtained by The Washington Post reveals HUD neglected its own environmental regulations at an apartment complex in East Chicago, Indiana, which was built on top of a toxic site. In 1998, a study showed 30% of children under the age of 6 had elevated levels of lead in their blood, but HUD took years to address the issue. The Intercept recently reported more than 9,000 federally subsidized housing properties sit within a mile of the Superfund site. The right-wing radio host Rush Limbaugh has died at the age of 70. His daily program was filled with racist conspiracy theories and disinformation and helped transform the Republican Party, leading to the rise of Donald Trump. Over the years, Limbaugh targeted Barack Obama, people with AIDS, immigrants, environmentalists, and feminists, whom he dubbed feminazis. He also downplayed the severity of COVID-19, climate change, and smoking. He died of lung cancer. And in Atlantic City, New Jersey, authorities have demolished Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino via a controlled implosion. Donald Trump opened the 39-story building in 1984, but it had been vacant since the casino closed in 2014, leaving 1,000 workers out of jobs. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in Texas, where millions were plunged into freezing cold and darkness as a major winter storm overwhelmed the state's underprepared power grid. At least 38 people have died. Hundreds of thousands remain without power as Texas faces record low temperatures. More than 12 million Texans face water disruptions and have been ordered to boil tap water to ensure its safety, even though many lack the electricity to do so. Some parts of Texas have no running water at all. Texas is also running out of food as the storm has disrupted key supply chains. This is a resident of Denton, Texas.
We had a fireplace, and I burnt up all the wood we had. This is sad. This is a sad state of affairs. I wish it were better, but, you know, somebody's got to do some planning after all this is over and make sure there's an alternative source of energy.
Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott took to Fox News Tuesday to blame renewable energy for Texas's blackout, saying the Green New Deal would be deadly for the U.S.
This shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America. Texas is blessed with multiple sources of energy, such as natural gas and oil and nuclear.
Cabot's comments contradicted Texas's own energy department, which said the outages were due to, quote, frozen instruments at natural gas, coal, and even nuclear facilities. Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted, "The infrastructure failures in Texas are quite literally what happens when you don't pursue a Green New Deal," unquote. There are three energy grids in the United States. In the West, in the East, and in Texas, which set up its own independent power grid, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, in the 1930s to avoid federal regulation. Now hit by cold weather, it collapsed. On Wednesday, ABC News asked ERCOT CEO Bill Magnus if Texas should be integrated into the national grid. This was his response.
Well, again, we've got to focus on getting this problem solved and getting the power back on. I imagine there's going to be, there will certainly be, you know, investigation of this event to determine what the right approach to going forward is. But today, I'm not really focused on going forward. I'm sure those discussions will come, but right now we got to get the power back on for people.
Meanwhile, in a blog post Wednesday by House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, titled What's Up in Texas, former Governor Rick Perry, who was Energy Secretary under President Trump, said Texans would prefer rolling blackouts to government regulations. Perry said, quote, those watching on the left may see the situation in Texas as an opportunity to expand their top-down radical proposals. Two phrases come to mind, don't mess with Texas and don't let a crisis go to waste. Texans would be without electricity for longer than 3 days to keep the federal government out of their business, he said. Well, for more, we go to Houston, Texas, where we're joined by one of those Texans who went without electricity. Robert Bullard is a distinguished professor at Texas Southern University, known as the father of environmental justice. He's the author of many books, including The Wrong Complexion for Protection and Confronting Environmental Racism, Voices from the Grassroots. He's also the co-chair of the National Black Environmental Justice Network. Dr. Bullard, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you describe your own experience and the situation of people in Texas right now, this devastating state collapse, which seems traceable back to just they didn't want to be federally regulated, and how it's disparately affected Texans?
Well, first of all, Amy, good morning. I'm really glad that my power is back on and can have this interview. I was out power for 2 days. The lights came back on yesterday. The temperature had dropped outside. I think it was 11 degrees. Inside my house was had gotten low 40s, 41, something like that. Very cold. We Texans are not used to that. And I've gotten calls from some folks in Houston. Their temps went in their homes went down in the 30s. To hear elected officials talking about we are proud to be off the grid in terms of the U.S. and Texans pride themselves as being the Lone Star State. But when it comes to this this cold spell and this failure, we are alone. We are the Lone Star State. The impact of this storm is more than just power outages and inconveniences for those communities that historically have been impacted by energy insecurity, energy poverty, having to pay a larger portion of their household income for energy. And this kind of disruption with this cold spell and with people having to raise the thermostat to keep warm will mean after this power outage has been restored, people are going to have high bills, utility bills, and some won't be able to pay and some will get shutoffs. That's the inequity that's piled on top of the inequity. And we see this happening all across the city as well as the state. And we're also dealing with the era of COVID. No power, no lights, no water. There's no way for you to boil water if you can't, if you don't have electricity. And there's no way to wash your hands and deal with COVID if you don't have water. So it's a pandemic. It's a catastrophe piled and converging, which is technically a mess.
And Dr. Bullard, could you respond to what the Texas governor has said, Greg Abbott, blaming renewable energy sources for the blackouts?
Well, you know, he made the statement and then walked it back. And then talking about we have a diverse energy portfolio. And as a matter of fact, the facts don't bear out what he said. And the, you know, the renewables outperform the other natural gas and coal and nuclear. We have to really look at science, and a lot of the finger pointing and blame game is not really based on science. Well, it is partially. It's called political science. And I think people who are suffering right now and hurting with no power, no money, no water, no form of transportation to get to the grocery store to get water, where there is no water, bottled water in the stores or food. They want to see action and answers. And there will, even the, you know, officials are calling for an investigation. But a real investigation would actually start pointing back to individuals that are in charge. And so I think the idea of Texas not being part of the union has really been a textbook example of how not to do it. We are a failed state right now in every sense of the word.
You know, talking about the issue of environmental justice, we were in Houston and interviewed you, Dr. Bullard, after one of the major hurricanes. And we were looking at the frontline communities who are so hard hit by these hurricanes, disparately affected, much worse than other communities. Then, as you said, you have COVID. You have some heating centers if people are lucky enough to get into one because the electricity is out in so many places. But I don't know if it's lucky because they're packed in like sardines when we're dealing with the pandemic. And then you have this issue of renewable energy. It looks like Governor Abbott went on Fox, on Hannity, to say this is about the Green New Deal, which hasn't even been passed yet. But then locally, knowing no one would buy it in the Petro Metro, where you live in Houston, or anywhere else in Texas, he walked it back. But that got out there into the right-wing blogosphere and Twitter sphere, and that's what they are blaming when we're talking about something like 10% wind turbines when they were supposed to be updated and they weren't. But so much more, the vast majority of the energy sources are not renewable. Can you talk about why you see this as an environmental justice issue? And you're so famous for saying, depends on who's at the table in deciding how we move forward. You have a complete failed state right now. How do the right people get at the table?
Well, it's important that we take a comprehensive view of what is happening here on the ground. The very communities that were hit especially hard during Harvey and the flooding, and as you map that, you can see it's the same communities overlaid that were hit the hardest, black and brown communities, by COVID. If you overlay the power outages and the rolling blackouts, et cetera, and you start to look at the releases from these refineries and plants because of unstable power, and the releases, over 300,000 pounds of pollution was released during this, you know, I guess 3 days or so, that created lots of problems in terms of potential health impacts, releasing of benzene, which is a known carcinogen. So we're talking about environmental, we're talking about health, we're talking about energy, we're talking about issues related to access to food and health care. All those things are rolled up in one. And when we talk about a solution, that means that we need to have the right people at the table when decisions are being made as to how we come out of this catastrophe with a solid plan, and not assume that, well, we can just paste it over and say we can go on as business as usual and not expect to have something like this to reoccur. Lessons unlearned. You know, we had a major power outage, I think it was 2011 or so, and there were no lessons learned from that. There was no lessons that we could have taken forward and strengthen our system, our grid, and to talk about building something that is solid, sustainable, and resilient for everybody. Now, there are some people that have not missed a beat. If you have a generator that's pumping in your backyard, or if you've, you know, have a credit card and can drive to a hotel and wait it out, your hurt and pain may be less than those who feel the hurt and pain first, worst, and longest. So we have to come through this with more people in those rooms in Austin talking about solutions, and not the same people who created the problem. We can't expect them to solve the problem.
Well,
that's not real.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Bob Bullard is Distinguished Professor at Texas Southern University, co-chair of the National Black Environmental Justice Network, known as the father of environmental justice, author of many books, including The Wrong Complexion for Protection and Confronting Environmental Racism, Voices from the Grassroots. Among other effects of this catastrophe in Texas and the surrounding states is the breakdown of distribution of vaccines. Next up, we're going to talk about, yes, COVID-19 infection rates are going down, but the CDC says it's way too soon to lift mask mandates. We'll speak with infectious disease Dr. Monica Gandhi. She'll talk about actually how to wear a mask or how to wear two at once. Stay with us. Yasmin Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. While COVID-19 infection rates and hospitalizations appear to be waning, the United States has a long way to go before it can safely return to a maskless normal. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control chief, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, has said it's absolutely too soon to lift mask mandates, citing daily COVID-19 case numbers that remain at more than double the levels seen last summer. She urged people to wear a more tightly fitted surgical mask or layer a cloth mask on top of a surgical mask.
The bottom line is this. Masks work, and they work best when they have a good fit and are worn correctly.
Yes, we are far away from this pandemic being over, especially with the surge of variants. For more on which masks to wear, how many, and also a brief discussion about vaccines, we're joined by Dr. Monica Gandhi, infectious disease physician, professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, and San Francisco General Hospital. She recently wrote a piece in the journal Med by Cell Press about how to wear face masks and is also studying the relationship between masks distancing and ventilation. Dr. Gandhi, welcome back to Democracy Now! As we talk about vaccines and the lack of access to vaccines is a whole other story in this country, not to mention the rest of the world, but it seems like people are relaxing around wearing masks. Can you talk about how critical it is right now?
Yes. So it is an important time to wear masks. Why? Because if we can get our transmission down as low as possible, that is actually going to make the vaccines more effective. This is because a virus can't mutate if it can't replicate. And also, we've never rolled out a vaccine in any pandemic ever in the midst of a pandemic. Usually vaccines are made after. So the lower the transmission we can get in the community, the better the vaccine is going to be for efficacy.
And Dr. Gandhi, as far as masking is concerned, some former Biden advisors have urged a wider use of N95 masks, saying that CDC guidelines don't go far enough. Your response, is that correct?
You know, actually, I think that they're both right. And what I mean by that is it is time to increase what's called the fit and filtration of our masks. But that there's many ways to achieve that goal. And N95 is just one of them. And what the CDC ended up doing is giving alternatives to that. Because N95s, though they're very fit, they have great filtration, they block out truly 95% of virus, they're uncomfortable, they're harder to get, and they actually have to be fitted. And so what our study and the CDC study was doing, they were both actually trying to attempt to say, what else could you wear besides an N95 that blocked out virus to the same degree? And so the CDC, just on February 9th, published an article in the MMWR that says, okay, are there other ways to increase the fit and filtration of our masks? And one way was putting this surgical and cloth mask together. Why? Because they filter in different ways. The surgical mask blocks electrostatically the virus. The cotton mask blocks it just through their fibers. And putting that together blocks as well as an N95. And there are other alternatives to that strategy as well. So they're sort of both right.
Dr. Gandhi, can you talk very quickly about how you think masks should be worn?
So it really actually depends on which setting you're in. And this is what's important. We have never done very good job in this country about tiered messaging. If X, then Y. But we have a paper coming out tomorrow on Lancet Infectious Diseases, which where we propose this non-pharmaceutical interventional triangle. And what that means is there's masks on one side of the triangle, distancing on the other side, and ventilation on the third side. And if one goes up, the other can go down. So if you're outside, no reason to wear a stronger mask. You're outside, you have ventilation going for you. If you're inside, and if you're an adult, because the middle of the triangle is host susceptibility to COVID-19, and if you're an adult, you want to increase your, while we're in this period still of decreasing transmission, but still ongoing transmission, you want to increase the fit and filtration of your mask. And there are two ways to do that, actually, the easiest ways to do that. One is an N95. The second is this surgical plus cotton together. You can layer it in whatever way you want. Since you just talked about Texas and the environment, I actually recommend surgical mask on top of the cotton mask because you can use then the surgical mask multiple times. And the third way is to take a cotton mask, and you can buy many of these on the internet, and it has a place for a filter inside. The two pieces of cloth with a filter inside block viral particles more effectively because the filter blocks it one way, the cotton blocks it another way, and it's actually quite a lightweight option to have stick that filter inside, take it out when you're washing it, and replace it after you've washed the mask.
And what are the most common mistakes in how people wear masks? I mean, a critical point, I think, if they're wearing, for example, a KN95 mask and a surgical mask on top of it, is not to wear that surgical mask, the paper mask, inside, but on the outside, because you'll break whatever seal there is. Is that right?
That is true, actually. So a KN95 is actually really quite effective. And if you get it from a reputable company, genuinely, you don't need any other layer because it really does block the 95% of the virus. But if you're going to put a layer on top of it, it is that seal around the face that is advantageous about KN95. And so anything you're putting on with it, you want to put on top. That's accurate. But really, to make it super simple, KN95 or 95, two masks together, but it has to be these two separate ones or the filter inside two cotton layers.
Dr. Gandhi, I want to ask about the question of transmission, which is, of course, crucial for this question of masks, that is transmission after vaccination. Since December 14th, when vaccinations began in the U.S., the U.S. has administered 55 million doses and is presently administering 1.8 million a day, which is the highest number in the world. You said recently, you quoted a doctor saying that it takes a special kind of pessimism to think that vaccines will not decrease transmission. Could you talk about that? What do we know about transmission of the virus after receiving two doses of the vaccination? And even if vaccination does decrease transmission, does it do away with it altogether?
This is a great question. So, you know, the reason this is even a debate is because the trials were designed in a way that they were evaluating symptomatic COVID-19. If you didn't feel well, you got swabbed. They said, you don't have COVID in the vaccine trial, and you do have it in the placebo arm. But it didn't mean that we never thought it would decrease transmission. And there is increasing data that these vaccines afterwards will reduce or eliminate asymptomatic carriage in your nose so that you can't pass it on. For biological reasons why we'd ever think that to happen. One is that the antibodies that the virus generates still get in your nose to clear viral carriage. They also produce another type of immunoglobulin called IgA that gets in your nose. Third is that even those monoclonal antibodies that we give for treatment and outpatient therapy, they reduce viral carriage in your nose. And then fourth is that in the macaque or primate models, when you gave someone the vaccine, it cleared it from the nose and the lower respiratory tract. We now see increasing data from the Israel and the UK, where rollout both are going actually extremely well. The cases are going down along with hospitalizations. They all block severe disease. But they also are blocking cases. And then swabbing of the nose of people after vaccination, the viral load is going down by fourfold. So it's very likely and almost definitive that it's going to block transmission. However, at this moment, until we know this like ironclad way, meaning we swab multiple people after their doses of vaccine, which is happening in the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine participants, and ensure there's no virus in the nose afterwards, we're recommending that the vaccinated, two vaccinated people can be around each other without that mask and distancing. But we're in a half situation where some of us are vaccinated, some of us are not. And so the vaccinated are still asked to wear masks and distance in public while we're waiting for the unvaccinated to become vaccinated. At a certain point, and I reassure the public, these masks will go away. But we're not quite there yet until we get to herd immunity.
And can you talk about the variants? I mean, right now, the South African and British variant are so serious in the United States. And the race between getting the vaccine in time for dealing with these variants. Now, with the storm in the south right now, we're in a very stormy New York, snowstorm in New York, but certainly in Texas. In the south, that has really broken the supply chain, getting the distribution of vaccines. So hundreds of thousands of appointments, it sounds like, around the country are being canceled right now because they can't get the vaccine. What about that race? Why is the variant so critical here?
You know, it's true that this virus is going to mutate. It always has mutated. It doesn't actually mutate that fast. It's just that we've had so much transmission right now that these spike protein mutations are coming out. There's one reassuring, one unreassuring. Reassuring thing is that even against the variants, all the vaccines block severe disease. And I mean the Johnson & Johnson study was examining in the setting of the B1351 or the South Africa variant. 95% of those strains in South Africa were of that variant, and Johnson & Johnson blocked completely hospitalizations and almost completely all severe disease, even if you're out of the hospital. Good sign. That's because T cells from our vaccines will block all severe disease. But when you're in a setting of replication, the variants can keep on going. There can be more mutations. And so it is a race. There is absolutely a race between getting everyone vaccinated and tamping down transmission. And so the more critical, the faster we do this, it's the most, it's incredibly critical. And we're in a complete race. And all of these, any blockage to vaccine distribution, like what you just mentioned in Texas and elsewhere, is a problem. But we're going to get there. But it makes the race more urgent.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Monica Gandhi, infectious disease physician, professor of medicine at UCSF San Francisco General Hospital. Next, we look at mounting pressure for President Biden to cancel student debt. Stay with us.
For a change shall come. We will be the makers of a new age. For a change shall come. For a light shall shine. We will be the carriers of a new fire. For a light shall shine.
A Change Shall Come by Star Busby. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to the student debt crisis, which tops $1.7 trillion in the United States, with some 45 million people owing money. Students, campaigners, as well as top Democrats have been pushing President Biden to use executive authority to cancel at least $50,000 in student loan debt. Biden was asked Tuesday about his plans to do so at a CNN town hall in Milwaukee.
We need student loan forgiveness beyond the potential $10,000 your administration has proposed. We need at least a $50,000 minimum. What will you do to make that happen?
I will not make that happen. It depends on whether or not you go to a private university or a public university. It depends on the idea that I say to a community, I'm going to forgive the debt, the billions of dollars of debt for people who have gone to Harvard and Yale and Penn and schools, my children. I went to a great school. I went to a state school. But is that going to be forgiven rather than use that money to provide for early education for young children who are come from disadvantaged circumstances?
Democrats hit back with Senators Elizabeth Warren and Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowing to keep pressing Biden, noting that both Presidents Obama and Trump used executive authority to cancel student debt. Freshman New York Congressmember Mondaire Jones wrote a piece recently in the New York Daily News detailing his own experience being saddled with student debt after leaving Stanford. He wrote, quote, canceling $50,000 in student debt is an issue of economic, racial and LGBTQ justice. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Wednesday Biden would not take any executive action until his Justice Department is installed and reviews the matter, and suggested Congress send Biden a bill to cancel $10,000 in student debt. For more, we're joined by Astra Taylor, organizer with the Debt Collective, who wrote the foreword to their new book, Can't Pay, Won't Pay, The Case for Economic Disobedience and Debt Abolition. Astra is also the director of the documentary You Are Not Alone. That's L-O-A-N. And Braxton Brewington, digital strategist with the Debt Collective, working to end the student loan crisis. Astra, so this is becoming a major issue right now. Of course, it has been for students who have debt. But right now, to the top, Biden is asked about this, and he puts his foot down. Your response?
He put his foot down and he put his foot in his mouth in the sense that it was a very meandering response. And it was very misleading. In fact, he seemed to be conflating two of his policies. So let's be very clear. Joe Biden ran on two promises. One, to cancel $10,000 of student debt across the board for everyone as part of a COVID relief package, acknowledging that we're in a deadly pandemic. In addition, he ran promising undergraduate debt cancellation for people who earn up to $125,000 a year, who attend specific schools, public colleges, HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. So we need to at least hold him to his basic promises. But what he did in that rambling response, he invoked straw figures, he invoked false scarcity and non-solutions. So, for example, you know, saying that we have to choose between investing in early childhood education and justice for student debtors. That's a false choice. These things are not opposed. What I take some encouragement from, and I think your listeners should as well, is that, you know, his press secretary clarified some of his remarks and said, as you just shared with us, that they're actually looking into the legal possibilities of executive action. So what I see in this is actually in their mixed messaging that this is very much in play. This is still a fight. And we have to be absolutely clear. President Biden has the authority to cancel all student debt. He was not being forthright when he questioned that in his remarks. He has the authority. It was granted by Congress decades ago, and he can erase all federal student loans, and he should. Debtors are not asking for debt forgiveness. We're asking for justice because Joe Biden, let's be clear, he didn't have to graduate with student debt. He talked about his kids and how they, you know, had student debt, but his generation was able to go to college and graduate without this enormous burden. So all people are asking for is parity to replace this broken system that he played such a crucial role in building.
And Astra, your response to those who've suggested that canceling a student debt through executive action could lead to legal challenges from student loan companies and other firms involved in debt collection. Is that correct? And these would not be risks if student debt cancellation occurred through through Congress.
So the legal experts, and here I'm relying on Eileen Connor from Harvard Law, are, you know, very clear that this authority exists. So if you are able to lend money, then you're able to not collect it, right? So if I lend you $10, I don't have to collect it. So the vast majority of student loans are held by the federal government. This is the government lending. The government has the right to decide not to collect. Now, sure, there would be some legal challenges. I'm sure there'd be some lawsuits. But what I'm hearing from the real experts in this space is that these are not major concerns. It's like, bring it on. Let's fight it out. But this is not a reason to be cowardly. And it's certainly not a reason to just rely on Congress, because we all know how broken our political system is. And so if Biden and his administration have this authority, they have this power. Again, it was granted by Congress in the Higher Education Act of 1965. This is not an overreach. Then use the power in your possession. And I think we have to be clear that not doing so is a choice. There's no limit. It doesn't have to be 10K. It doesn't have to be 50,000, which is actually the researchers who proposed $50,000 based on thinking about racial justice and other factors have actually updated their figures in 3 years. So now the people behind 50,000 are saying 75,000. But he can cancel all federal student loan debt, and we have to be clear, not doing this is a choice.
I'd like to bring Braxton Brewington into the conversation. Braxton, can you respond to what Biden said and talk about your own experience as a student and with debt?
Absolutely. What Astra said couldn't be further from the truth. Not only is it a choice, it's a policy assault. The individuals that would benefit the most from student loan debt are individuals like me, black and brown borrowers, mostly black women borrowers, who frankly have upwards of $35,000, $50,000
hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt that could benefit from this policy. And President Biden has a unique opportunity to bring together a broad coalition of individuals who and otherwise would be unlikely to come together around a policy. We know that 1 in 5 Trump supporters said they would consider supporting Joe Biden in the election if Joe Biden were to cancel student debt. And we just saw an NBC survey the other day saying 40% of Black voters would consider sitting out the next election if Joe Biden did not consider supporting student loan debt. And we also know that non-voters, a great way to bring non-voters into the democratic process is to cancel student loan debt. So this is a tool that is widely available to President Biden, and him not using, executive action to cancel full student loan debt is a policy assault on people, individuals like me, who frankly voted for Joe Biden in hopes of, this policy becoming a reality, because we know that not only is this a student loan debt crisis, but there's a pandemic where people are in perpetual fear of losing their lives. And the last thing folks like me need is to be worried about debt that the federal government has frankly proved over since March and into September that they don't need our payments to in order to create revenue for the government to function.
So, Braxton, talk about your own experience. Where did you go to college? What kind of debt did you accrue, and what would it mean for it to be forgiven?
Yeah, I went to North Carolina A&T State University, which is the largest public HBCU in the country. I graduated with 2 bachelors, actually, in journalism and political science, like many of my partners, and I accrued in my name tens of thousands of dollars worth of debt. I haven't checked recently, but it's upwards of $35,000, $37,000. And that's just the debt that's taken out in my name. My parents were fortunate enough to be able to take out a loan in their name on my behalf. And so when we accumulate all of that debt, it's even more than the debt that I have. And how has that affected me? Luckily, I'm only out of college for the past couple of years, and so I've been in deferment. I haven't had to make any payments on my student loan debt, but I was gearing up to a couple of months into the pandemic. If the pandemic didn't happen, I would have had to start making hundreds of dollars worth of payments. And I think one important thing to realize is that 40% of people who have student debt don't even have that diploma. So we are expecting people who went to college and for whatever reason did not get their diploma, and we're expecting them to pay that debt when they're getting paid what a high school graduate earns. And so, you know, there's lots of aspects to this as well, not forgetting seniors. This is an intergenerational issue. Seniors who can get 15% of their student loan checks, their Social Security checks garnished for student loan debt, which is insane. And so this is an intergenerational issue that affects not only myself and my peers, but seniors and the people that I'm in community with. And so I can't stress enough that, you know, again, to not for Joe Biden to, we're 30 days into this administration. That is 30 days of a policy failure that President Biden has allowed in terms of not canceling student loan debt.
And Astra Taylor, I wanted you to respond to this tweet of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. As soon as Biden talked about not going to 50,000, she struck back. And among the things she has said is very wealthy people already have a student loan forgiveness program. It's called their parents. The idea that millionaires and billionaires are willingly letting their kids drown in federal student loans, and that's why we can't go big on forgiveness, is about as silly as it sounds. Explain what she's saying and what you see at this point needs to be done. Fit in Jubilee 100 with this.
Brilliant. I was going to quote that tweet because it's so spot on. So one of the common responses, and when I said Joe Biden invoked these straw figures, this is what I was pointing to. He painted this portrait that student debt cancellation would lead to cancellation for people who went to Harvard and Penn, you know, and the argument is essentially that student debt cancellation is regressive because this stereotype of affluent, Ivy League educated people would get relief. You know, as Braxton brilliantly just laid out, that's not the case. That's not the real demographics of student debt. The children of millionaires and billionaires do not take out debt to go to school. Their parents pay the price. They pay the price of tuition up front. What that means actually is they pay less over time because people like Braxton have to borrow, and their parents, they borrow money and they pay interest. So people who are poor pay much more for the same degree over years and decades, because that's the way that debt works. So student debt itself is regressive. It's means tested. It hits the people who have the least income, the least intergenerational wealth, who are the most vulnerable, the most likely to face wage discrimination at the workplace. It hits them the hardest. And so this is why Joe Biden's framework is deeply flawed. We need to push back on this and say it's an economic justice issue, it's a racial justice issue, and canceling student debt is also a democracy issue, because we all are entitled to live in a society where our fellow people can pursue education. We're not going to get to full debt cancellation without organizing and pushing Joe Biden. He is famously the senator from Delaware, the credit card capital of the world. He has helped create this crisis. He's made it harder for student debtors to get relief over the years. It's organizing that got us to this point. We have organized a student debt strike, the Biden Jubilee 100, 100 strikers symbolizing his first 100 days, demanding justice. We invite people to go to debtcollective.org to sign up for phone calls, for events, and for upcoming protests to push this administration to use the power they possess to do the right thing and to start to enact this FDR-sized presidency that we've been promised and that we do not seem to be getting.
Astor Taylor, we want to thank you so much for being with us, organizer with the Debt Collective and author of the foreword to the new book, Can't Pay, Won't Pay, The Case for Economic Disobedience and Debt Abolition, and Braxton Brewington, digital strategist with the Debt Collective. We want to thank you both so much for being with us. And before we end today, I wanted to take note of this year. Nermeen, it is your 10th anniversary with Democracy Now! It has been so amazing to be on this journey with you. It also coincides with Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary, which we're going to do much more on tomorrow. But it has been such an honor and an education for me, learning from you for this decade.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's been such an extraordinary privilege for me. Working from you and I, working with you and working at Democracy Now! And I've learned more from you and from all of my colleagues than I could possibly express. Thank you.
Well, we're going to go right now, just a snippet. We're going to play a whole hour tomorrow of Democracy Now! Over the years. But 4 years ago, right when Trump was elected, he imposed the Muslim ban, one of his first acts in office. You raced to JFK Airport, where a massive protest was going on, and filed this report.
We're outside New York City's John F. Kennedy Airport, outside Terminal 4, where thousands of people have gathered to protest the Trump administration's executive order, which has prevented many people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. More than 10 of them here detained at Terminal 4. Thousands of people here chanting, "Let them in. This is what democracy looks like, and refugees welcome here." Let's talk to some of the people here.
My name is Mamida Ahmed, and I'm here today because as a Muslim woman, I find this ban extremely just personal to me, because I have family members who are on visa, and now they are at risk of not being able to leave or enter the country.
For Muslims who are here already in the U.S. under a Trump administration, under this administration?
Well, I would say all my Muslims, brothers and sisters, there's nothing to fear. Your actions are more important. Keep doing what you're doing, and we are not going to do anything wrong. We are going to be unapologetic Muslims.
And that was Nermeen Sheikh out at JFK Airport right after President Trump was elected and imposed the Muslim ban. Nermeen, I can't wait to spend so many more years with you here at Democracy Now!, but together here in studio when this pandemic ends.
Me too, Amy. I miss being there.
Well, can't wait. Tomorrow, an hour on Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe. Wear two masks.